36 tonight. This will be the third week that we've been in chapter 36. Jesus has been, we've talked about the Lord's Supper, we've talked about his betrayal, his arrest. Now we're going to be moving into the section where he begins the trials. Now there's several things about the trials I want to brief you on before we even get into the text. If you look at the accounts listed in all four of the Gospels, including John as well, we have Jesus' trials. There are three Jewish trials, two of which are illegal according to Jewish law. We also have three Roman trials. So a total of six trials that took place between the time that Jesus was arrested until the time that he was basically sentenced by Pilate. So you have, according to John, the first place after Jesus was arrested was taken to Annas. He was still called a high priest, but he was not the sitting high priest. He was actually the father-in-law of Caiaphas. Caiaphas was the high priest at that time. But apparently Annas still had such a reputation and whatnot that people felt, whoever arrested Jesus, that they would take him there first. So that's where he went first. After he appeared before Annas, he was taken before Caiaphas and the Sanhedrin. That's the one we're going to be looking at tonight, is taking before Caiaphas. Then, of course, he appears in chapter 27, verse 1. He appears again, this time before the chief priests and the elders. Now, the two and three are probably related, but we're told there's additional individuals there, and they're spoken of differently. It's not it wasn't the high priest; it was the chief priests, and of course the elders of the people as well. Then you have the Roman trials. Jesus appears twice before Pilate. Twice. In between those two, he appears before Herod Antipas. Herod, when Pilate found out that Jesus was originally from Galilee, he sent him to Herod. And then Herod couldn't get Jesus to do any kind of magical tricks, so he sent him back to Pilate. So you see there's these were the trials that Jesus was subjected to. The two before Annas and the one before Caiaphas, both of those are illegal because they were done in the middle of the night. There were to be no trials of any sort like that in the night. Not even the Gentiles would practice that. They would not practice that time frame because it's not like people could be aware of what's going on. So that's what took place there. But the two trials before Pilate, at the first trial, Pilate understood that, this is because of jealousy, so he sends Jesus to be scourged. And he's sent on to Herod, and then he returns. And when he returns, the crowd demands not to let Jesus go, since he's been scourged, but they still demand that he would be crucified. Okay? So that's kind of what was going on there. You're going to see some irony. Irony in the way that the chief priests and the Pharisees, Sadducees, how they responded to Jesus. And some of their scruples really kind of make your head swim. Here they are plotting a murder, but they don't want to become ritually unclean. Here they are planning a murder and even giving money to the betrayer, but at the same time, they don't want that money to be used for any kind of religious purpose because it's been used for blood. They didn't care. They wanted witnesses, false witnesses, but they couldn't get the false witnesses to agree. I'm going to add some more injustice to this whole scenario. He was convicted of one thing before the Sanhedrin. But that conviction is not what was told to Pilate. So the charge changes. And that's really interesting that you keep that in mind, that the charge that the Sanhedrin charges Jesus with or convicts him of is not the charge that Pilate is told. Pilate is given a totally different charge. And so you can see how nefarious this whole situation actually ended up being. There was no justice in it. There was not even a pretense of justice. They were determined, saw the opportunity to kill Jesus, and they went for it full throttle. Didn't matter that what they were doing was wrong. And well, we'll get to that in more detail. Verse 57. Those who had seized Jesus led him away to Caiaphas, the high priest, where the scribes and the elders were gathered together. But Peter was following him at a distance as far as the courtyard of the high priest, and entered in and sat down with the officers to see the outcome. Now the chief priests and the whole council kept trying to obtain false testimony against Jesus so that they might put him to death. They did not find any, even though many false witnesses came forward. But later on, two came forward and said, "This man stated, 'I am able to destroy the temple of God and rebuild it in 3 days.'" Okay? So they're trying to get... Now, these witnesses are false witnesses, pseudo-witnesses. They're fishing for something. The problem is you had to have two or three witnesses, but they couldn't get the witnesses to agree on what Jesus had done that was wrong. And then they finally get two to agree, and those two agree by stating that Jesus said he would destroy the temple and 3 days he would build it back. Now that might be offensive to Jewish leadership, but it's not a capital crime. So next, the high priest speaks. Jesus, verse 63 tells us, 62, the high priest stood up and said to him, "Do you not answer? What is it that these men are testifying against you?" But Jesus kept silent. And the high priest said to him, "I adjure you," or "I put you under oath by the living God, that you tell us whether you are the Christ, the Son of God." So what the priest does now, the high priest, Caiaphas, he puts Jesus under an oath, meaning you have to answer. Jesus thus far has stood there in silence, thus fulfilling the prophecy in Isaiah chapter 53. Like a lamb is dumb before its shearers, so he opened not his mouth. He didn't speak. He didn't defend himself. He just allowed the false witnesses to contradict each other. And it's obvious this was a major setup. So the high priest has enough of it. So he says, "Okay, under oath, or I adjure you, are you the Christ, the Son of God?" Jesus answers. He answers by referring to two Old Testament passages. He says, Jesus said to him, "You have said it. Nevertheless, I tell you, hereafter you will see the Son of Man seated at the right hand of power and coming on the clouds of heaven." So what's going on here? The first is Psalm 110. "The Lord said to my Lord, 'Come and sit at my right hand until I make your enemies a footstool.'" Now, it is God's covenant name. It is what we would say, Yahweh says to Adonai. And David's writing this. So that's the first one. The second one is Daniel chapter 7, verse 13, where it talks about the coming of the Son of Man. The Son of Man comes in the clouds of glory. He takes those two messianic prophecies or statements from the Old Testament, he weds them together. So what he does is he definitively answers the question. He does not answer it yes or no. He answers it by referring to what the Old Testament has prophesied. Okay? So at that point, the high priest tore his robe and said, "He has blasphemed. What further need do we have of witnesses? Behold, you have heard the blasphemy. What do you think?" They answered, "He deserves death." Okay. So, before the Sanhedrin, what's the crime?
Blasphemy.
That crime is only a crime if Jesus is not the Son of God. If he is the Son of God, it is not blasphemy. But they, looking at Jesus, assuming he is, or considering him to be just a prophet, indeed one that is noteworthy, but nevertheless just a man, they looked upon what he said as being blasphemy. That's the charge. That's the only thing that they can point to. The high priest points to that. We don't need any more testimony. We don't need any kind of correlating evidence. You heard him say it, right? They knew exactly what he was referring to. So now, before the Sanhedrin, he has been convicted. Okay? Now, what's next? Well, the high priest, in a symbolic fashion, tears his robe, showing grief, showing that he is offended deeply by what Jesus has just acknowledged. All right? So, in his mind, and in the minds of not everyone gathered there at this time, are it's not the full Sanhedrin. We know that Joseph of Arimathea was not there. Nicodemus probably was not there. There would be several that were conveniently not notified about the trials in the middle of the night. I mean, when you want to get your way, you pack your court for your benefit. And that is just human nature. That is human nature. Had a friend a number of years ago. There was some dissatisfaction going around in the church, and there was a vote. They were going to vote on something. I don't remember what it was, but a particular faction was in favor of it, and not everybody was on board with it. But when it came business meeting night, everybody showed up. People who had not been in church for years showed up to vote. That's why we need to be careful about how we structure our constitution, and we took care of that. By identifying what an active member is. If a person's not an active member, they have no business voting. If they may be on the rolls, that's fine. But if they're not involved in the life of the ministry of the church, they really don't have any ground to stand on. So anyway, nevertheless, they stacked it. So they left certain people out who may have been no more favorable toward Jesus. Joseph, we know, of Arimathea was. Nicodemus, we find in John's Gospel, at the end of it, he too was favorable toward Jesus, as well as probably others as well. There may have been other members of the Sanhedrin that were conveniently not notified about what was taking place. Things are moving really rapidly here. I know there's six trials. It sounds like there's going to be it takes up a lot of time. But everything is pretty compact around where they were. So it didn't take long for these things to take place. And again, by the time some of these individuals had found out about it, it was already too late. And that was by design. That's why they were having these trials in the middle of the night. Are you with me there? I think porch light's on, but I'm not sure everybody's home. looking out there, you're pretty sedate tonight.
All right, so that's going on. And then after that, verse 67, then they spat in his face, beat him with their fists, and slapped him, and said, "Prophesy to us, you Christ, who is the one who hit you? So they start abusing him. Right there before the high priest. Right before the Sanhedrin. Again, something they were not supposed to do. There's one occasion where Paul was slapped when he was before the Sanhedrin. An argument, or at least implied, that maybe Paul's thorn in the flesh had to do with his eyes, that maybe he didn't see real well. Because in Galatians, he tells the Galatians, he reminds them, if you could have, you had given me your eyes. And so anyway, he's before the Sanhedrin. The high priest, he says something. The high priest ordered him to be struck. And Paul's response was simply to that, may God strike you, you whitewashed wall. And then somebody said, well, how do you speak to the high priest such disrespectfully? And Paul's response is, I did not know he was the high priest. Might lead credence to the whole idea that Paul's eyes were an issue.
I think that goes back to when Paul met Jesus on the road to Damascus.
That's what it is, yeah. He was blinded there, and something like scales had fallen off his eyes. Now, we don't know that, but there's a little bit of circumstantial evidence that might suggest that. So anyway, Jesus is being abused here, right during the Sanhedrin. Now things are going to shift. The scene from Jesus before Caiaphas and the Sanhedrin is now going to shift to Peter. All right? Now Peter, he's sitting outside in the courtyard. A servant girl came to him and said, you too were with Jesus the Galilean. But he denied it before them all, saying, I do not know what you are talking about. When he had gone out of the gate, another girl, servant girl undoubtedly, saw him and said to those who were there, this man was with Jesus of Nazareth. And again he denied it and said on an oath, I do not know the man. I want you to notice something. Each one of these is getting stronger. Peter's denials. They're not getting softer. They're getting more, a little more energy behind them. They're getting stronger. And later, bystanders came up and said to Peter, surely you are one of them, for even the way you talk gives you away. He has a Galilean accent. Okay? A Galilean. And if you know this, you don't have an accent, do you? No, of course not. But if someone from Jackson, Mississippi happens to come by, you can tell they've got an accent. Or if someone from Brooklyn, New York. Yeah. Or if somebody comes from Boston, you know they're from Boston because they don't use R's. They can't pronounce an R. You understand what I'm talking about there. Peter has a Galilean accent. And they're pointing that out. Hey, you sound like a Galilean. You must be one of them. This time, he began to curse and swear, I do not know the man. And immediately the rooster crowed. Immediately the rooster crowed. He's going to remember what Jesus had said about that crowing rooster. Now, as you saw, the intensity of his denials increases until you get to this one. A man that talks like Peter just did surely was not a follower of Jesus. He's cursing and swearing. And I don't know if that means using bad language or if he's just calling curses down upon himself or something like that, or on who's asking the question or whatever. But I want you to notice the gaining of intensity. And the intensity, though, is going to come to what I would consider a crescendo next. Because when the rooster crows, Peter remembers. Now, before we get to his emotional reaction to that memory, what would add, what, why do you think, well, let me read the verse, and then we'll talk about it. And Peter remembered the words which Jesus said to him, "Before the rooster crows, you will deny me three times." And he went out and wept bitterly. Now, you can participate at this point. Why do you think he goes out and weeps bitterly? Yeah, yes.
Because he told Jesus that he would never deny him, even if I can't remember what it was.
He'd go to his death with him.
He knew he failed.
Yeah. And he does fail. Jesus told him he was going to fail. That he was not as strong as he assumed that he was. He was not as dedicated as he felt that he was. He wasn't as committed to Jesus as he probably had considered himself to be. I mean, he's one of the inner circle. You know, Peter, James, and John. He's the one whose name is always first. So he was the one always willing to speak up. He was the one that probably felt of himself in pretty good standing with Jesus, of course. And now, when the chips are down, he caves.
He's also the only one that walked on, only one of the disciples who walked on water.
And he's saying, too.
Yeah, he's saying.
And he's the one, John tells us, Matthew, Mark, and Luke doesn't identify him, but John does identify him. He's the one that cuts Malchus's ear off when Jesus is arrested. So he's impulsive. He's very impulsive. You know, act first, then think. Kind of the wrong order. But at this point, though, he is, things are not going well. I mean, it's going from bad to worse. He knows it. And he can see what's going on. He can hear about what's being said. He can understand that this does not look good. So he caves. Now, there is something about this, though, I think is very, very instructive for us. Sometimes we may think of ourselves as being people, well, if I was ever put in that situation, I'd never deny the Lord. Or, you know, if things ever get, you know, rough for Christians in our nation, I'm going to stand my ground, and I'm going to be faithful to Christ through the, no matter what comes. We say those kind of things. It's easy to say that when there's no pressure. It's quite another when things are happening all around you. And so in the first century, now it's after this period of history, about another 40 or 50 years after the ascension of Jesus, that Christians were put in very, very difficult situation. If you read 1 Peter, you begin understanding that, because Peter is consoling suffering Christians. Yes.
Yeah, if we ever take the mark of the beast, they don't separate a lot of 666 or whatever it is.
Right. There's going to be, it's just, sometimes we think, in certain, you know, like in this kind of environment, we can make all kinds of claims. But when pressure is being immensely applied to us, it's quite different. You know, you may not be as quite as prepared as we think we might be. Yes.
Do you think he was thinking maybe there would be consequences to his denial?
I think it was just a heartbreak that he was devoted to Jesus, but when Jesus needed him the most, he caved. He betrayed. Judas betrayed Jesus, but so did Peter. Not on the same level, not the same kind of betrayal, but betrayal nonetheless. But it wasn't just Peter. The other disciples split.
Yeah.
They ran and to hide themselves as well. But anyway, about 50 years, give or take a little bit, after this, at the resurrection of Jesus, Christians were finding themselves in dire straits. And they had to make decisions, big decisions.
For example, when you move into Asia Minor, the seven churches of Revelation, for example, that region, at least many of those cities there, not all, but many of those cities, the Christians were under a lot of pressure. For example, the nearest thing I can compare this to is a union. Unions are not quite as strong as they used to be, but for a period of time, they were really strong. And they had what was called trade guilds. So if you worked with silver, you belonged to a trade guild. It was like a union. If you were in another trade, maybe you made pottery or something like that, or you dyed clothing or made clothes, any of those things, there would be a guild that you would be a part of. Each one of those guilds would have a patron deity, a false god, that the people were expected to worship. Now here's what would happen. Say if you were in one of those areas, and this is before the Roman government. This is another kind of persecution. Okay. You trusted Christ as your Savior and Lord. You are no longer going to the temples. You're no longer worshiping the patron deity, the false god, of your guild. You ask about it. You tell your buddies there that you are a Christian now and you follow Christ. You can no longer do that in good conscience. Well, they might think they get kind of offended, and basically it frees you out. Nobody would buy your stuff. You were now unable to make a living. So what do you do? Let me ask, what do you do? So, you no longer can feed your family. So you're in trouble.
This is no Christian's God candy took care of my mother.
Yeah, there was a lot of that. You had to survive. That was one form of persecution. There were other forms of persecution that later came down the pike. Where if you did not... if you did not pay your respects and swear allegiance to Caesar, if you were in a principality there that was given to honoring the emperor, you could find yourself by the authorities telling you they're going to seize your property. They're going to take it from you. You either burn incense or you lose your property. So you had a lot of pressure that was building. If you read 1 Peter, you'll understand what I'm talking about. Peter is talking about suffering Christians.
This goes on in many parts of the world today, too.
Boy, it does. Because you'll find yourself no longer... Well, you don't have to go. You don't have to leave the United States. You can take a Jack Phillips, who's been in court for the last 15 years, been to Supreme Court twice. He keeps winning, but he's still tied up in court. He's the cake baker that refused to make a cake for a gay couple, couple of homosexual men, and in Colorado, he was taken. He was sued. He ended up in court, and he's still in court. Now, he was set up as well. Everybody knows that. When he declined, he gave the gay couple the names of other bakers that would make their cake. So it wasn't like they could not get their cake made. He was just not, because of his own Christian convictions, he was not going to bake the cake. So, but here's the irony of it. One of someone, I don't know who it was, they had a video they produced some time after that. They went to some bakeries around in the Colorado, in the state of Colorado, and they went to Muslim-owned bakeries. And they asked the same thing, to which the Muslims said, "No, we won't make it for you." But was there any charges against them? No. They're left alone. So you do see some of this. There have been some other Christians that have been actually put out of business. There's also moves. This is what matters, who sits in the White House.
Yeah.
Because there are individuals that have found themselves in trouble, even like adoption agencies. In some areas, Catholic charities no longer work with adoptions. Why? Because by law, they have, if a gay couple wants to adopt, they have to treat them just like another couple. A normal couple, husband and wife, want to adopt. Well, they don't want to do that. And we have our own issues. Because, you know, we have the Baptist Children's Home, Family Services. We have the branches of there, you know, Angels Cove, along with Grace Haven. Both. They're always watching the law to try to deal with those issues when they're mandated. And of course, we don't live in a very Christian-friendly state in that respect. So it's already, those kind of things are already issues. What happens if the issues continue and go a little more like, well, you're a part of a church, so we're going to cancel your health care. You don't think they'll do that? Absolutely. There are some that would love to do nothing less than that, to force you and me to comply. I'm not making this stuff up. I mean, it really is. Now, it's not to the point of health care yet, but it's not about a realm of possibility.
Andy, what about the school in Southwest Missouri? I can't remember the name of it. They were told by the federal government, I believe, that they had to, they had female and male dorms. It's a Christian school. And the government came in and said, you can't do that. The boys and the girls have to live together in the same dorms or same dorm building or whatever. And they took it to court, mm-hmm. fighting it in court. Has it ever been resolved? And what school
is it? School is College of the Ozarks, and they lost the case.
Oh.
But they're still, you know, legally fighting that, so they haven't. They don't have co-ed dorms. So that's still going on. But that's just in Missouri. Now, see, the thing of it is, what you got to remember, now this is how all this stuff gets all tangled up, is that if you receive in any way tax money, like a Pell Grant or anything like that, along with that comes government regulations. It seems that the government officials forget that money comes from us to begin with.
Right. Mm-hmm.
That's why I'm totally in favor of school vouchers. That you pay taxes, you should be able to send your kid to wherever school you want to.
Mm-hmm.
Why let this public school system have a monopoly on teaching your kids? You should be able to send them wherever you would like to, and the state should honor that by sending the money that would have educated your child to this particular school, send it to this school instead.
Does the College of the Ozarks receive government funding?
They receive the Pell Grant, so yes. Now, you can get away from that if the institution does not receive any kind of government or money through government. Like, I think Hillsdale College in Michigan does not receive government funding. But education costs are enormous at universities. And just so you know, anything that the government subsidizes is always going to cost more.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? I mean, just common sense. If first-time home buyers are going to get $25,000 more, you know what that means? It means the house is going to cost $25,000 more.
Yeah.
You subsidize it doesn't help. It makes it worse. That's why I like, you know, subsidize buying an electric car. Well, if you want an electric car, get your electric car. But subsidize those things, and it doesn't help in what I'm saying. It doesn't help. So, but yeah, it's still an ongoing legality, but you know, that's just the reality of it. And education is very, very expensive. Especially college level education is very expensive. And it's hard to navigate that stuff. So anyway, back to this. Peter folds just as Jesus told him he would. Oh, back to my, I was leaning toward it about 50 years after this. There was, in portions of the Roman Empire, I've mentioned to you before, the so-called Dea Roma. It was a once-a-year thing where people were to appear at a certain area in their town, and they were to burn incense, drop incense to be burned before either a statue or a bust or something representing Caesar, and they were to swear allegiance to Caesar. It was not that he was a god, but that he was their lord. And there were kind of three different approaches that Christians had to that. There were those that would absolutely refuse to do it. They would not do it. And they suffered greatly because it was looked upon not as a religious objection, but as being traitors. They were not loyal to their government, as it were. So they some suffered there. Others said, hey, I don't mean it. If it gets them off my back, I'll do it. And they give you a little certificate afterwards that you had done it. So they'd go up and they would drop the incense, cross their fingers, and say, you know, Hail Caesar. I don't know if they crossed their fingers or not. So they did that. And then there were others that bought, kind of on the black market, those little pieces of paper that said they had done it, but they hadn't done it. So they felt like they had the best of both worlds. They would be left alone because they've got the paper, but at the same time, they really didn't swear allegiance to Caesar. It's kind of like back, I don't even remember, when they had the COVID passports. You couldn't go into some restaurants without a COVID card. And some people were buying those without getting the shot. So it's the same thing, the same basic thing. Okay. So Peter finds himself remembering, I'm sure, that he had sworn that he would not, in any other circumstances, he would not abandon Jesus. But Jesus said, you all will flee. No, not me. The others said the same thing. But then, when the chips were down, they were gone. The positive thing was, their failure was not permanent. That reveals something about God's grace, right?
Amen.
You know, Michael Card wrote a song a number of years ago, a long time ago now, and he titled it Why. W-H-Y. And he writes about some of his songs, about how they came to be and whatnot. He said he just sort of asked a bunch of questions and tried to kind of come to some sort of answer to them. You know, why did Judas betray him with a kiss? Why did they hang him on a cross? Why did they do this? And that, you know, hopes and things like that. But that was one that he wrote. He wrote another one, though. I don't know if it's in that song or another one. And it was called The Traitor's Look, which he was looking at Judas. Said only a friend can betray a friend, because no one else could cause that much pain. It's not people that you don't know that betray you that hurts. It's those that are closest to you that betray you. That's what hurts.
Yeah.
Those that should support you that don't. But anyway, and one thing that traitors look, it says something like this. Judas, don't come too close, for I'm afraid that I might see the traitor's look upon your face may look a lot like me. But just like you, I've sold the Lord often for much less. And like a wretched traitor, I betrayed you with a kiss. There are times all of us we betrayed him. We stayed silent when we should have spoken. We chose to sin, instead of refraining. We've ignored him when he feel when we sense that the Spirit is leading. So we can find ourselves pretty, like Michael Card writes in that song, that traitor's look, that, you know, Judas, you might look a lot like me. Anyway, chapter 27, we'll begin 27, we won't go very far in it. Now when morning came, all of this is the night before, you know, but when morning came, 6 a.m., it's starting to get daylight outside. Now when morning came, all the chief priests and the elders and the people conferred together against Jesus to put him to death. And they bound him and led him away and delivered him to Pilate the governor. Then when Judas, who had betrayed him, saw that he had been condemned, he felt remorse and returned the 30 pieces of silver to the chief priests and the elders, saying, I have sinned by betraying innocent blood. But they said, what is that to us? See to that yourself. Not very sympathetic, are they? And he threw the pieces of silver into the temple sanctuary and departed and went away and hanged himself. The chief priests took the pieces of silver and said, it is not lawful for us to put them in the temple treasury, since it is the price of blood. And they conferred together and with the money bought a potter's field as a burial place for strangers. For this reason, that the field has been called the field of blood to this day. Then that which was spoken through the Jeremiah the prophet was fulfilled. And they took the 30 pieces of silver, the price of one whose price had been set by the sons of Israel, and they gave them for a potter's field, as the Lord had directed me. So we've got the conclusion of Judas. We have Jesus being delivered over to Pilate. And this is where we're going to see, and we'll probably end up right here, we're going to see that the charge changes. What was he convicted of?
Blasphemy.
Blasphemy, right? Okay, that works well before the Sanhedrin and Jewish people. Pilate doesn't give one bit, he doesn't care a bit about blasphemy. You can go blaspheme all you want. He don't care. It's nothing to him. So you'll see the sleight of hand here. Now Jesus stood before the governor, and the governor questioned him, saying, are you the king of the Jews? And Jesus said to him, literally he says to him, you say. Any other words before that have been supplied by the translators. But, no, it is as you say. You say. Now, what's the charge? Is it blasphemy? No. What is it? It's treason. Now, Pilate cares about this. He cares about the charge that there is a rival to Caesar. That he does care about. And that is now the charge. Now, to be perfectly frank with Caiaphas and his instigation of all of this, yes, he asked Jesus, are you the Christ, the Son of God? Jesus' response is quoting or referring to two passages in the Old Testament. But now, it's not it's blasphemy there, but now it is treason. Because if they come and say to Pilate, hey, he committed blasphemy, and Pilate's going to say, don't waste my time. Go away. Leave me alone. I got more important things to listen to you. You people complain about things like this. I don't want anything to do with that. So that's why they change it to now that he's claiming to be a king. Jesus' response is somewhat affirmative. And while he was being accused by the chief priests and the elders, he did not answer. Again, fulfilling Isaiah 53.
Then Pilate said to him, "Do you not hear the many things they testify against you?" And he did not answer him with regard to even a single charge. So the governor was quite amazed. Probably because the charges are all kinds of things they're slinging that direction. And probably blasphemy is just not one of them. All right? This is the irony of what is taking place here. Caiaphas is the high priest. He is ultimately in charge of the temple worship. That is his domain. The chief priests and the elders of the people, they are, many of whom are on the Jewish Supreme Court, the Sanhedrin. Very prominent men, very important men. And many of those would be very religious men. Caiaphas, he's more of a political figure, but he still has some religious leanings that have to be dealt with. He is the one that does offer the sacrifice on the Day of Atonement. He still has that particular function. But in the midst of all of that, they're plotting a murder, an execution. They have trumped up charges. They have inconsistent charges. They have no charge worthy of death. They have false witnesses. They have bribed a betrayer. Are you following all of this? They broke the law in having two of these trials before daylight, in the middle of the night. That's just simply against Jewish law. And there they've done it. And not only that, they take the real charge, and then they change it. Because the Romans don't care anything about the real charge. Nothing. So you see all this duplicity going on? This is a quote worth writing down, or at least memorizing. Back to one of my favorite professors, Dr. Coble. He said, "When men set out to defend God, they will often do it just like the devil." And that is absolutely true. That is absolutely true. And if you probably think about it long enough, you probably can think of occasions where that's exactly the case. You want to defend God's honor, but do so just like the devil. And that's exactly what we have transpiring here in the chapter, including part of chapter 26 and chapter 27. They're willing to do whatever they have to do, however they have to do it, to get their end results. To them, the ends justify the means. In other words, if you get the result that you want, whatever you got to do to get there is okay. All right? Is that a good way to live? Answer is no. No. How you get there is just as important as there. So the end does not justify the means. And that's something for us to remember. But pragmatically, that's how a lot of people operate. Whatever I need to do to get to this particular goal, I will do. Regardless of whether it's right or wrong, is not the point. And we need to be conscious and careful about those kind of things. All right, any concluding thoughts? Because next time we'll pick up in verse 11 following and through the crucifixion.
Do you have a question?
Yes. Could have been. Could have been.
Second question is, did the priest not have any remorse over paying blood money to have, I mean, they lied, they executed him with blood money. They don't seem to show any kinds of remorse for it.
No remorse, but you can have a little higher opinion of them here. They knew they couldn't use that blood money in in the temple. We can't do that. But what we can do is we'll buy a field for people who be buried in that can't, don't have any family or anything like that. We'll just do that. You know, a pauper's field to bury people in. That shows some of the duplicity. If it gets, now, John, if it's a finer point on it, when they go before Pilate, they make Pilate come out to them. Because, you see, they didn't want to go in. Because they went into a Gentile area, they would defile themselves, and they could not celebrate a supper that night. Not in their minds. But see, that's the irony of how the human mind, the sinful human heart, thinks. How it reasons. As long as I don't do that, I'm okay. It's called rationalization. We rationalize things. You know, someone who's embezzling from a company, they say, yeah, I'm just unofficially borrowing money. I intend to pay it back. Before you realize it, or before they realize it, see, what they're doing is they're rationalizing. They don't have permission to take that money, but they think I'll replace it, and no one will know the difference. Everything will be fine. My crisis will be over. No problem. Not realizing that, no. Your good intentions are probably nothing more than you're rationalizing that you're actually going to do this, when in reality, you're not going to. It's kind of like this is a true story. The IRS received the letter, and the letter simply said, and included a check. The letter said something to this effect. I have been cheating on my taxes and not paying that which I owe. Please find, and before we get to the please find, he said, I have not been able to sleep well for weeks because of cheating on my income tax. Therefore, please find the enclosed check. And if I still can't sleep, I will send you the rest. Literally, it really did occur. Okay? That's how we think as human beings. We will rationalize. We will make excuses. You know, that kind of thing. And it's really surprising how sometimes people will do one thing that might be criminal, but they'll say, but I did pay my taxes. And, you know, look at something positive to somehow offset whatever they did that was not. That's how we think. All right, thank you so much. And next time, well, like I said, we'll pick up with verse 11 and following.